Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. This is episode 268 of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in and downloading. This is the podcast, of course, for vinyl record collectors and music maniacs. We try to get the stories of the record on the record, and today we've got a marvelous show. Mr. Steve Hackett joins us again. This is his second time on the show. It's always fun to talk to Steve. Now, Steve, as you know, he was a member of Genesis. But that was about 5-6 years of his career, and he spent about 30 after that on his solo projects and various other guest appearances and things like that. So Steve has quite a history to him. Of course, we're going to talk about Genesis and get some old stories about that time and talk a little bit about, you know, potential Genesis reunions and his relationship with his former bandmates. But also we talk about his new music. We talk about his relationships with other guitarists, Eddie Van Halen, Peter Green. And he even talked to him about Brian May. Apparently, Steve is mates with Brian May, and they've spent some time together. And we also talk a little bit about the Beatles. John Lennon, you may or may not know, was a fan of Genesis. So we talk a little bit about what that was like, being anointed by a Beatle. We talk about a lot of different stuff, and Steve has a lot going on right now. Several releases this year, some of them on vinyl. He's got some rescheduled touring dates. All that information and more you can find out at hackettsongs.com. Steve's also got a new book, A Genesis in My Bed, an autobiography, very entertaining. You can find that online as well. Get the Kindle version, be reading that within moments. And if you enjoy this interview, we've got an extended version, more content, more chit-chat with Steve, available at our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. And by going up there, of course, you help support the show, and you get access to all sorts of extra content, blah, blah, blah. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Mr. Steve Hackett.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, fine, yes.
It's been a crazy couple of years here since you've been down to Australia, but it seems like you've made the most out of the time that you've had. New album, yeah. A new book, yeah. Lots of things. You just can't sit still, can you?
No, it's been three albums. It's been a live album, a book, one studio album, which is acoustic stroke orchestral, and the next one is we're working on the last track today. We've just got a few guest appearances to get into that, and then it'll be released later in the year. So, No, it'll be extraordinary to have produced in some shape or form three albums in the space of a year.
Wow.
I seem to be going for the hat trick at the moment. I think without any loss of... I like to think without any loss of quality of ideas and what have you.
Now, you've remained incredibly prolific, really the last decade. Nearly an album a year, something along that pace?
Yeah, I figured that as others were slowing down, I felt reinvigorated and I wanted to renew my commitment to music. The thing that fires me up and always has done ever since I was a small child. Mm-hmm. So, yes... I must be going for the John Wayne Award, a little bit like, you know, the amount of Westerns he did. If I can, how many Westerns was it? 70-odd Westerns? If I can squeeze in 70-odd albums by the time I shuffle off this mortal coil, that won't be bad going.
What are you up to now?
Well, it all depends. It depends whether you include the Genesis ones and things I've shown up on and all the live albums and all that. I mean, that's got to be about 100 albums or so. But... specifically studio albums I've done myself, it's about 26 or 27 now, something like that.
Well, let's go for 70. I think that's a good number to shoot.
Go for 70, yeah. Assuming I live until I'm 130, it should be all right. Yeah.
Well, the wonders of modern science. Now, when you go to write these records, do you have like a backlog of songs that you pull from, or do you tend to write them pretty much they are of the time?
No, I think they are of the time most of the time. There might be the odd melody that I'll allow to surface. For instance, I was working on a track today, And there's a guitar part on it that was originally, I had an idea that it would make a vocal phrase, and then I thought as a vocal phrase it would come out sounding very 1960s pop, but by changing it and playing it on guitar and playing it in a more fluid style, it doesn't sound that at all. Mm-hmm. You would never know. It just comes out as melodic. But the new stuff is kind of, it's kind of metal orchestra. Mm. It's a strange hybrid of lots of heavy metal, lots of orchestra. It's a strange hybrid of many things. It's a collision of many schools of thought.
Do you over-record and create outtakes, or pretty much what you record gets released?
Well, you know, what's tended to happen in recent times is that the Japanese start asking for bonus tracks. And again, Joe said, you know, sometimes people don't so much do bonus tracks as bogus tracks. You know, here's a mix. It's just the tambourine. Yeah. And there's another track. We don't do that, but sometimes we do usually instrumentals that are very, very quick. Mm-hmm. And most of the time they would have a germ of ideas on that normally I would develop over a much slower period. But there are times when I've gone at this and said, whatever I do today is going to be the track. So you make up your mind very, very quickly on things. And sometimes I'll end up playing those things to people in embryo form. They say, oh, I really like it the way it is. Why don't you use that? And then I have to figure out, well, what am I going to do if I've robbed Peter to pay Paul? So I'll take, there was one thing that we had that just came out absolutely perfectly. And it was a day's work and sounded heavy as hell. Again, this sort of orchestral meets rock thing. And great use of samples on it. I was working with Ben Fenner on one of these ideas a couple of albums ago. And we ended up using it just very much as it was on the day. It was, people were responding to it immediately saying, oh, I like that. And, that sounds really frightening. Grown men were saying how frightening it sounded. So I thought, well, job done with that. You know, that's...
If you evoked an emotion, if you're provocative, then that's the purpose.
Yes. One tries, you know, to make it cinematic, perhaps, and occasionally literary. Other times it's just pure, completely adolescent and just having a burn-up on your guitar. There's room for all of those schools of thought.
So what are you listening to these days? Do you listen to much modern music?
You know, I often turn on the radio and usually turn it off immediately because I know where it's going. It's like someone has put some sequencer on, gone off and made a coffee and come back again, and it's still going. So much of modern music seems to be non-variation-based, non-developmental. Singer sings a couple of lines, recapitulate, change slightly, alter the technology. There are some people I like. I like Joe Bonamassa. Mm-hmm. I like his playing. Met him a couple of times, complimented him with stuff. I've enjoyed Muse as well and Elbow, and I've spoken to some of those guys from Elbow. And I enjoy some of the British bands are interesting, but I think someone like Joe Bonamassa, it's a little bit like the case of Hendrix, not really having been recognized in America, but making his base London in the 1960s and taking off in a big way here, where amongst his audience he happened to have the Beatles from time to time, holding up a mirror to America, and then America has got the sort of reflection of it, or the reflected glory of sanction, perhaps, of British approval. And I think, in a way, although it's many decades later, Joe Bonamassa, I think, being recognized here with a number of guitarists. The last time I saw him backstage, it was full of guitarists, you know, and top names, and, you know, slapping him on the back. And, you know, that's very nice. To reinvigorate the blues, I think, is no easy feat, because blues, you know, operates in a smaller framework. But to re-energize it, I think, is a very clever thing to be able to do. So I approve of the complete honesty and energy of that that approach. So
the authenticity
authenticity, that's a very, very good word, I think. Authenticity, yes. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. Authentic music. Yes.
Yeah. This last year we've unfortunately seen the loss of many musicians, one of which Eddie Van Halen.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, you and Eddie had a bit of a history early on. What did Eddie Van Halen mean to you?
Well, I think that, you know, he was a brilliant guitarist. Never met him. I know that he came to one of my shows, and apparently I'm an influence on him for the tapping technique, which I was doing in 1971. But, you know, he was incorporating that as it's become part of the glossary of terms. And, of course, a brilliant player. On the British side of things, the loss of Peter Green as well, who I used to go and see practically every other week in the mid-1960s, was a tremendous loss. I saw him playing with John Mayall and met John Mayall when he was just about a week short of his 80th birthday. And Mayall said, I'm going to be playing a show next week for my 80th birthday. And I thought, you know, he's the real thing. That's the way commitment should be. B.B. King, John Mayall, and cut from the same cloth in a way, if not the same background, certainly that level of commitment. And what was fascinating was my brother bought me a live album recorded in 1967, which had Peter Green, and the rhythm section was what became Fleetwood Mac. So you had three members of the future Fleetwood Mac. And although it's a tape recorder at the back of the room somewhere, so it's you don't listen to it for its hi-fi properties, but in terms of performance, it's fabulous. And you hear the young Peter Green, the reason why we hero worshipped him at that time, when they were just two guitarists on the planet, both of whom had been with Mayall's band, and it was Eric and it was Peter Green. So, you know, that was hard to beat. Eddie Van Halen, again, it's at one stage removed. I never saw him play live. And most of what I know is from two tracks. Of course, the famous solo on Beat It, which is fabulous, and Jump, which is a great keyboard riff as it happens. And then snippets of things and the odd bit of film and seeing something and thinking, yes, that's an interesting technique. So, you know, it goes from me to him, back again, you know, being able to do chops on the whammy bar. Wah, 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 wah. You know, all these things. And guitarists are like gannets, you know, they listen to each other and they hear something. They, yes, I can take that, I can take that. Everyone becomes my teacher because I never had to learn lessons in the conventional sense of the word, but it meant it was all ears and eyes for anyone who was doing anything remotely interesting on guitar. So that'll take you into flamenco, that'll take you to classical rock, blues, jazz, technique driven. But I think essentially to be able to write a song over and above what you do on guitar is it's important to be able to pull back from the technique of wrestling with the frets and the wire every day of our lives, as we do guitarists. And if you're a nylon player, then, you know, wrestling with your nails as well, trying to get the nails the optimum length. Over and above all of that, to be able to write, and all writing comes from a doodle, so don't imagine that anything comes out as an opus, just straight off. It doesn't work like that. But
when you pick up a guitar, is it with the intent of practicing? I mean, I'll be very dry and say it's like playing scales, but just to warm up, or do you pick up the guitar with an intent to write something?
Often it's just to get the feel of the strings under my fingers. And then the intention is to surprise myself, to see where the fingers might go today that I hadn't thought of yesterday. So most of the time, all the techniques that the guitar techniques in the world don't surprise me, but there's those moments when something gets through the scanner, something gets through under the radar, a new idea. Too much logic does not a great guitar solo make. We want surprises. We want the fireworks if it's electric. Other times you want to be a voice. There's a style of playing which uses either Ebo or the Fernandez guitars with sustain pickups, where the aim is to play legato. It's to play very flowingly and gently, even with distortion, which I know is an oxymoron, but to be able to play fluidly and sliding between those phrases where you're not using it as a percussion instrument. Other times I've got my Les Paul in hand, and it's an old instrument. It's an old classic instrument. It's, I guess it's the Stradivarius of of the electric guitar world, really. Mm-hmm. That brilliant old instrument that goes through new technology, which actually makes it sound like a classic 1960s sound, which I'm always chasing, really. I've worked with other people, great guitarists. I worked a little bit with Brian May, who has a fascinating sound, of course, and is no stranger to the use of upper harmonics with his sound, the guitar he built himself, putting two pickups out of phase with each other, and at times making electric guitar sound more like a trad jazz band, impersonating wind instruments. So mm-hmm. he was perhaps not as much of a percussion player with his instrument. These other things, I think, that there's in spirit, you know, there's a trombone player there, there's a clarinet player, all of those things, and you can see this sort of stuff many times. They're showing stuff on TV with, you know, Brian explaining his sounds and the approach that they had, the mm-hmm. multi-layering of guitars and vocals to create operatic ideas and using the guitar, you know, very much as a kind of mechanical synth in a way.
When I hear your music, it does remind me a bit of Brian May for that same reason you just brought up. It's almost like an orchestration through that instrument. It's interesting you bring up Brian as well, because he built that guitar with his father.
Yes,
What do they call it? The Red Beast or something, whatever.
I don't know what he calls it, but it's a very nice guitar, and they've made copies which do mm-hmm. the same pickups, and you can hear those tones via the copies. I was even tempted to get one myself. I have a pal who has one, and I played it for 2 seconds. And, oh, that's how he gets that sound. That's how that works. You know, that's so these mysteries. You know, eventually they reveal themselves pretty much like harmonica tones as well, which is my first instance. How do you get that great sound?
Do you listen to other guitarists like that? Like in that example with Brian May, did you then take that, I guess, a few of those tricks back with you and use them for your own style?
I think you've always got to try and do your own version of what it is that you like about someone else. And when I first met Brian, he said to me, oh, I liked Musical Box, that track, you know, first Genesis album. They said, oh, that your guitar playing on that influenced me. And I thought he's the guy who came up with three-part guitar harmonies. But he'd noticed that right at the end of that track, there was a three-part guitar harmony. And it served the line very well. Ever since I did that, I've never really come up with a line that was as good that suited a three-part harmony, a climbing part right at the end of the track, climax to the track. But he'd noticed that. And of course, the Genesis approach was very much, if there was a song that was guitar-based, it usually meant lots of 12 strings all chiming away, doing sympathetic parts, but not exactly the same parts. And by the time you heard that, you couldn't really tell whether you were listening to guitars or keyboards, especially if something was put through a Leslie cabinet or two. Yes, you know, you would be getting something that was closer to keyboards. That would be softening it, but to come up with a third instrument is often the intention, isn't it? You know, oh, what is that sound? Who was that man? You know, these sounds are what drive us, I think, all the time. Imitation being part of it.
Now, in your new book, A Genesis in My Bed, which I read over the last week, which is absolutely hilarious. I'm not going to give away to the audience why it's called A Genesis in My Bed, but they can read and find out themselves. Very amusing. You mentioned that part of your Genesis highlight was when John Lennon took an interest in the band. What form was that? How did you learn about that?
Well, we were just about to leave New York to go to LA because we couldn't get a single gig between this is Genesis 1973. We couldn't get a single gig between New York and Los Angeles. So we were spending money hand over fist that we didn't really have. We were going to arrive 2 weeks early in LA and have a holiday before we played the Roxy Club. Three nights, all sold out, everywhere else in America, never heard of you, not interested, no gigs. Just as we were about to leave, Peter Gabriel turned to me and said, just heard that John Lennon gave an interview to, I think it was WNEW, probably Scott Neely, God bless him. And John Lennon said, he was asked, are there any bands that you're listening to currently? And he said, Genesis is one of the bands I'm currently listening to. So that was probably more important than the fact that we weren't getting any gigs. I thought, of course, practically 50 years later, we would have tweeted that news. That news would have been out there. Yes, one of the great man's, favorite pinups is ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Yeah, it didn't work like that. There was no bush wire. It was a best kept secret for a very long time. And then I started putting the odd thing in sleeve notes and certainly thought I'd mention it in the book because that level of sanction you cannot buy. And I think it's much on the same level as Robert Fripp talking about King Crimson when Hendrix shakes his hand. You know what I mean? There's just something that is, you can't buy it. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's so important, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You will never forget that.
Being anointed by a Beatle, that's quite...
Indeed, yes. Sanction doesn't come higher unless Segovia said, hey, man, I really dig your... And how do you do your nails every day? That wasn't ever going to happen. But I know that Yehudi Menuhin, the violinist, and John Lennon were on a TV chat show. And Yehudi Menuhin used a piece I'd written for a film that he was making, narrating, and all the pieces were classical. And then there was a piece from Please Don't Touch, which was guitar and flute. And I'd seen these two, John Lennon and Yehudi Menuhin on TV having an argument. Mm. They were disagreeing about something that, and I absolutely missed it. It was something that the violinist said to the singer, which set him off. And I think he said, oh, grow up. And I thought, they're disagreeing. But all these years later, there was an agreement that something I did then with the band I worked with then and something that I did on my own, there was a point of concurrence. And so I must have done something right. These things mean a lot in personal terms, and they're very hard to get across to people in the other sense of the word. But it's when a fellow professional who's dedicated their whole lives to music, and of course, Yehudi Menuhin was a prodigy. There are pictures of him in short trousers with his violin, and he's on the steps of Abbey Road, and he's just about to record with Edward Elgar, the old man is shaking the boy's hand. You realize what a legacy there is. And again, of course, there's the synchronous tie up with John Lennon all those years later, mm-hmm. Abbey Road, all of that. So I guess the apple doesn't fall that far from the tree. And music is really all about, as John Lennon said, the same old notes. We just kind of put them in a different order.
Well, there's that lineage, right? That lineage of greatness that transcends the generations and goes through the decades and brings us up to present day, which today, you are taking these lessons. You are someone's John Lennon out there. In fact, there's many people who look to you that way. Do you feel part of that legacy, part of that timeline?
I tell you, I think Keith Richard, sometimes gets very eloquent and he'll say something about passing on the candle or something. All that can be said is that it gets passed on. If you keep going and if you're remotely good at it, something will out, something will get passed on. And I think the only person that can really fail you, because the only difference between an amateur and a professional is that a professional keeps trying, the only person that can really fail you is yourself. As long as you keep trying, and even if you don't get a break until you're in your 50s or your 60s and something gets through and something sticks. Yeah, I'm working with a friend at the moment who's come to music quite late in life, but he's writing things to a very high professional standard and recording them to a very high standard. And I'm very pleased to have played on this album of his. And, I consider him to be a discovery. And I think it's so important not to give up. As Peter Gabriel says, along with Kate Bush, do not give up, mate.
The great philosopher, Peter Gabriel.
Yeah,
so let's talk about your relationship with Peter and Genesis for a little bit.
Yeah.
I know you probably get asked all the time if there's ever going to be a Genesis reunion. I think most of us are relinquished to the fact there probably will not be. Right. But what's the closest the five-piece ever got to truly getting back together?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, vinyl collectors. Do you know that AudiophileUSA.com has a ton of original jazz records? 7,383 to be exact. Many of them audiophile quality and ready to ship to you wherever you are. Over at AudiophileUSA.com, you'll find Blue Note, Music Matters Jazz, Analog Productions, and heaps of other titles, all in excellent and near mint shape. Some of them are even still sealed. So don't be slow. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated vinyl record dealer, and with over 42,000 vinyl titles in stock, there's something for everyone at AudiophileUSA.com. Go to it. And when you get those records, you're going to need something to clean them with, which is where the Groove Washer record cleaner comes in. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner on the market. I use it daily, and it keeps my records clean, my listening experience wonderful, and my collection in archival shape. Other record cleaners can leave a residue on your vinyl, which over time can make your records gummy and sticking to their sleeves. Don't risk devaluing your collection. Ask for the Groove Washer by name, and look, here's 10% off anything at groovewasher.com. Use checkout code VINYLGUIDE10. Do it now. Groovewasher.com. Checkout code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
So let's talk about your relationship with Peter and Genesis for a little bit.
Yeah.
I know you probably get asked all the time if there's ever going to be a Genesis reunion. I think most of us are relinquished to the fact there probably will not be.
Right.
But what's the closest the five-piece ever got to truly getting back together?
Well, we did have a get-together in 1982. We did something to bail out WOMAD. Really, that was as a gesture to Pete. And apart from that, I think, you know, we talked about a get-together again in about 2005, but although we all got round the table literally together, almost immediately it seemed to fall on stony ground and the same old issues came up. And unfortunately, you need everyone to tango simultaneously to make the dance. And that can be very difficult with five guys who hadn't worked together since they were 24 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, 25, actually. Very hard to turn the clock back that far. You would be wrong to think that everyone's inflexibility. Some people are flexible, others are not. Mm-hmm. Name no names, but it's not easy. You know, people have agendas, vested interests, various things that no fan wants to hear about. No one wants to hear that their hero is a selfish git. No one wants to hear about that. It's my band. You're not going to play with me. I say what goes. You know, really, musicians are like children a lot of the time, and to see it from the fans' point of view is totally, totally important. So for me, I don't get pleasure of playing live unless fans get pleasure out of it. And so if I could give fans more pleasure by doing something, then I would. But I don't kid myself that my old outfit is not, you know, possibly the most competitive team in the world. You know, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's like it goes a little bit like this. You know, sometimes we will privately congratulate each other, and then the same day that you got the congratulation in word form or phone call, you are being publicly denounced by the same person into that same day for the same thing. So, you know, you've got to have your helmet on with that kind of thing. Do you know where I'm coming from?
Oh,
you know, publicly,
well,
yeah. Privately congratulated, publicly denounced. I rest my case, Millard.
So there are still cordial terms between all the members now.
Yeah, well, no. We talk. There's communication. I had communication from Tony the other day, Tony Banks. I had conversation with Pete. We normally phone each other up on our birthdays. And I'd already spoken with him a couple of months before that. So you know, we talk about all sorts of things, health issues, as mature guys do, and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And also about music, philosophy, and life, and all the rest.
Yeah.
We're alarmingly normal in our private lives. It's just when it comes to the professional thing, it's, that tango just never seems to quite entwine.
Now, in that early Genesis lineup, there wasn't an event or a breakup. It was somewhat of a disintegration. Peter left, then you left. There was never really any closure. Was there any desire to have that level of closure with like a set of reunion shows? Was that important to you? Or were you just always happy just to let it be what it was?
I think it's probably easier to work with individuals. You know, there have been odd things where, you know, we turned up on each other's gig or album or what have you. But to do the full Monty, so to speak, that's much harder if that's what you mean. Mm-hmm. I prefer to try and honor the ideas that we once shared and take them a stage further to orchestrate them, literally have an orchestra playing some of those things plus a band. So, my big thing, I think, has been to bring these separate worlds of what groups do and what orchestras do together. And I think that's called a solo career, ironically, because it's very, very hard to get, I mean, for instance, you know, with Genesis, there was always, you know, from the word go, there was the idea that, oh, you know, everything must be done in-house. We must never use anyone outside. And so that was great for all sorts of things when you happen to have the right drummer who happened to be a virtuoso, et cetera, et cetera. But there were times when, you know, perhaps you need an expert ice skater, you know, to take part of in that game of ice hockey, because we know that that's going to send the puck further. I'm getting obscure here with my references.
Yeah, but with the set group of guys, it's a limited set of tools, no matter how talented they are.
Right. Exactly. And there was something about the way of the Beatles developed where they were mature enough to say, okay, we've got to down tools and we're going to use the old instruments, or we're going to use these instruments we've never heard of from India and we're going to make that work. And yes, I don't have to play every beat myself. And I think that's the mature way to look at it, to play to strengths, to sing to strengths, to write to strengths, and to work with George Martin, of course, who was a presiding genius in the arrangement and production department, where perhaps you could say he was Beatles number 5 and 6. I think, you know, that's terribly important. Arrangements such as I Am the Walrus and, you know, the two great arrangements are I Am the Walrus and Ellen Rigby. That those arrangements for musicians will always be on Olympus. That's the thing. And my theory is that all art, all music is, it's a kind of salvage. It's a rescue service. Things, the ideas are already sunk. You've got to bring up this sunken wreck and reflate it. Ideas don't work at first. Not complicated, complex ideas. If you want to do something truly new, you've got to be prepared to say, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this works. Mm-hmm. You know, we throw away the things that don't work, but we polish these ideas. And I'm so happy when someone says to me, I don't think this really works, because we can do this. Why don't we look at this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm usually very, very, very happy. And I don't know what it is that makes something work, but I think it's attention to detail, really. There's no magic formula. You've got to love it enough to stay with the ugly beast until you turn it into a swan. Really, you've got to polish that diamond until it shines. Mm. It doesn't happen immediately. No one gets all the ideas all the time. Nobody knows what's right until it's finished. You know, I don't think there's such a thing as genius. I think there's just hard work. You know, I think Tchaikovsky says something about, you know, inspiration doesn't come easily to those who don't work hard. I'm paraphrasing, but it talks about or talked about, you know, the amount of work that it might take, which is why those orchestrations, of course, are probably the best ever. The sonorous use of orchestra I can think of is from Tchaikovsky's Pen.
Mm.
Yeah.
I always thought genius could be defined as the speed in which one can solve a problem. So if, in your example, you know, you're working on a song, someone says, I don't like this, the ability to then react and respond to that with a few other variations or a few other options,
yeah.
If you're able to do that problem solving rather quickly and with, you know, a few different choices, to me, that kind of that person has a little bit of a spark, maybe what people call genius. But yeah, that was always my interpretation of that.
Well, I think genius is a shared thing, isn't it? That's the original word root is that. Mm. And someone else will come up with an idea that you hadn't thought of. But instead of feeling threatened by that idea, if you can incorporate it, and it's not as if it's an insult to your manhood or your whatever you call it, you take on board that idea and you use that idea. It's a free gift. You know, someone else comes up with a better title than you thought of yourself. Yeah, absolutely. Someone's got a better guitar sound. Whatever it is, you know, you might think that the drums are fine and someone else will say something about, oh, you know, no, we need a drum break here. We need that there. Have you thought of this harmony? You could have a saxophone on this. And it goes, oh, yeah. To be open to all of these things and to know when it works. I mean, Roger King often says to me, when we're up to 200 tracks on something, he'll say, never knowingly under excessed. But there are moments when we draw it all back, you know, we might have four symphony orchestras on something, but there'll be a moment we take it right down to nothing. And I think, yeah, maybe that's the best kind of monsters, the way I see it. Keep it rootsy. If that works for you and you've got a little blues band and you've got this great hotshot young player, then great. Yeah, you don't need them.
Hmm.
You don't need all that. But I need complexity. I need to satisfy the inner Tchaikovsky and the inner George Martin and the all the rest. And the inner Hendrix and the inner Django Reinhardt. And the list goes on endlessly. You know, I listen to these people. You know, what is it you could bring to this that I haven't thought of? Yeah, discarnate soul, please show me the light.
When you exited Genesis to pursue the solo career,
yeah,
what was that change like for you? What complexities did it present that you hadn't dealt with up to that point and perhaps that you didn't expect?
Well, it made me physically ill. I mean, within a year, I was in hospital with intestinal ulcers. And
the stress?
The stress of that and probably just doing the wrong things and excess and smoking too much dope and drinking too much red wine. And then a year later, I'd given all that up and I became a jogging fanatic and doing all the things that I'd been able to do as a kid in the school gymnastics team. I thought it's time to put aside all that kind of heavy, hardcore living and thinking, you know, if you want to prioritize doing lots of music, you need to be fit. So somebody said to me at one point, it was a guy who worked in adverts, an old friend of mine who then left the UK, went to America and did a lot of, you know, very successful things in film. And he said, you know, somebody said to me, you have to be very fit to be successful. Yeah, you know, we have this idea that, you know, we could get as wasted as Keith and get away with it, you know, and that's what success is all about. But I would say very few have that constitution. And, you know, the older I get, the more I'm aware of mortality. So you come to a point where you prioritize things. In fact, I saw this woman who was a psychic it was the first time I'd ever visited this particular sort of psychic center and she absolutely read my mind. She knew about all sorts of things that she couldn't have known about when I was in my mid-20s. the names of people that were private and everything. And she said, and by the way, you've got a slight shadow on your right lung. And I'd just finished my first solo album. I was smoking like crazy, like an expectant father. And I was eating very little, puffing away like crazy. And I forgot about what she said, but that night I went to bed and I had a huge asthma attack in the middle of the night. And I stopped smoking from one day to the next. I just thought, this is it. Well, stop doing this. It was an intention to stay healthy. So all we can do is, you know, try and get as much out of, you know, this as possible. I don't know. You can either take the, you know, there's the Hendrix route or there's the Segovia route, really, isn't there? You know, it's like you're either going to be playing when you're 93 or 94, or you're going to peg out when you're in your mid to late 20s because you're achieving inspiration another way. Equally gifted men, totally different philosophy.
So once the weight of the career came directly on you, wasn't shared with the rest of the band, that
yes,
was
it was a huge wake-up call.
Right.
Absolutely, you know, because you're in a band and
you share the burden.
So, yes, you share the burden, you share the glories, well, there is no such thing as a band. It's a collection of individuals, and the work that they do is something else which has another personality, the sum of all the parts and all that sort of stuff, all that kind of thinking. But it's very different with a solo thing. Now, with a solo career, it doesn't mean to say that you have to actually, you know, write and play everything yourself. You don't have to do Tubular Bells Mark II. You don't need to be a genius, but you do need to be honest. And if you can find a writing partner, I think that's a very good thing. If you insist on writing it all yourself, yep, but it'll take you longer. To work with sympathetic people where you encourage each other to try a little bit harder, that's priceless. But, you know, ideal writing partners don't grow on trees. Competitors do. Partners, genuine partners, do not.
Now, when you started your solo career, this is at a time where punk was getting underway.
Yes.
Did that pose any challenges? What was the reaction of record companies or fans?
Well, yeah, I you know, luckily I built a kind of following myself, but I immediately became very unfashionable as far as the press were concerned, the British press particularly, because I was considered to be the old guard, you know, and I thought, hang on a minute, I'm just starting out on my solo thing. And then suddenly to not be new was, you know, you can change everything, but you can never change not being new. But then you have to accept that the trade-off is I have more experience, I have amassed more skills, I am chancing my arm or my voice doing certain things that I wouldn't have thought of before, and I've discovered that I have become Caruso, or I've become whatever it is, or good enough to, if Dylan can get away with it, then, you know, then maybe this guy can, you know, in terms of vocal capacity. What is your priority? For a Dylan, it's the strength of the words. Always has been. Mm-hmm. For somebody like Jimmy Webb, it's got to be the strength of the harmonic changes and the poetic license that he inherited, mm-hmm. perhaps from all those church services that he attended under the auspices or the threats from his father. You know, favorite writers, Jimmy Webb, certainly.
But at any point, did they try to mold you in a different way? Did anyone ask you to get a mohawk?
Nobody asked me to get a mohawk. Nobody asked me to do that. No, I think it was Nick Beggs who said to me, come on, I've got a kilt. Why don't you wear one tonight? And I thought, my legs aren't that great, you know. I don't think I'm ready for that. And he was going on in a leather kilt and pigtails at one point and calling himself the Nazi Heidi. For me, I thought, no, I'm just going to stand there and play. Ideas for a gimmick, could you all put them on a card and send it to blah, 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 blah. But so far, there's been, you know, so far, no gimmick. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping before I die, I'll come up with a gimmick. We'll see.
Well, look, you've made a lot of music on a lot of different labels. I want to suggest people go to hackettsongs.com. Sure. There are plenty of vinyl records to be able to check out. A blue pressing of Under a Mediterranean Sky that's signed. That's available. Genesis Revisited at the Royal Albert Hall, a 3 LP set there. Of course, the book, Genesis in My Bed. You made a lot of music on a lot of different labels. Do you control it all? Do you have all the master tapes, or is there anything missing?
There were a couple of masters that were lost, unfortunately, and that's because I trusted in record companies and recording studios, and that was a very bad idea. So ever since those days, everything is more tightly controlled. I suppose the long-term aim is to own all one's own masters, but I think you can try to control most of it. Let's just put it this way. Yeah, you can aim to get a high success rate or spend your life in court. It's not worth it. It's a very expensive sport, all of that. Mm. The best asset you have is yourself, as you know. That's not really replaceable.
That's a great attitude, because
and to love what you do, and it'll take you to hell and back, you know, still in one piece.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show again. Really appreciate all the conversations we have and the wisdom that you're sharing. I want to again remind folks, hackettsongs.com, Steve's new album, Under a Mediterranean Sky, is available there. Of course, his book, A Genesis in My Bed, that could be available immediately on Kindle if you want to get to start reading it right now. I recommend you do. And of course, take a look out for Steve hitting the road, hopefully again, in 2021 and 2022. What do you call the tour now?
Well, we're calling it Seconds Up, basically. There will be some other stuff too, but it'll be plus. But it's mainly, you know, Seconds Up is the you know, the full Monty, full versions of those things. Lots of rescheduled shows, mm-hmm. because of the pandemic. We're all subject to that, but looking forward to getting out there on the road. We all need a party, don't we?
We certainly do. And we hope to see you down in Australia as part of that party kicks off.
Me too.
Here in 2021.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steve Hackett. Again, everyone go to hackettsongs.com for the latest on Steve. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please consider becoming a patron of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us there. Of course, you help support the show. You get extra content, extended interviews, early access to episodes, heaps more. patreon.com/vinylguide. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes across your social media. Post them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. That is a huge help. Of course, please also leave us a positive review on iTunes or whatever platform you use to get these podcasts. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something nice. Make us blush. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, go out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.